RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. We're at RPGLL Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, rpglpodcast@gmail.com, and check us out online at rpglessonslearned.com.
Hi, welcome to the RPG Lessons Learned Podcast, the show where you can learn from our mistakes. I am Tanner, one of your official co-hosts. Dusty is nodding approvingly. Am I doing okay?
You're doing great.
Oh, God. Okay, good. We're going to talk about an adventure that I ran for you this time, again in Scarlet Heroes. But yeah, Hideous Daylight by Brad Kerr, however that's pronounced, the same author of Temple of a Thousand Swords, an adventure that both you and I hold in very high esteem that we talked about a couple episodes ago, right?
Man, this one, like that one was great. And this one was also great. And you tried the making slides in a PowerPoint approach that I had tried in our adventure before this and in our last episode, An Awakening at the Old Well. How do you feel like the PowerPoint methodology worked?
Like you said last time, it was more work than I thought it was going to be. The structure of the adventures were pretty different too, sort of the scope of them. While Awakening at the Old Well was sort of a linear sort of exploration of one space, Hideous Daylight was our first hex crawl that I've run for you, or that we have played together. So if you're not familiar with that, the structure is sort of that it's a region made up of hexagonal sort of tiles, and you're kind of free to explore overland wilderness style between them. You can leave, you can come back whenever you want. It's very much a more open type of sandboxy adventure, and that was harder to do, I think, with PowerPoint. I think the prep was longer and the execution, it felt to me like it was straining the limits of what that sort of PowerPoint format could handle. Did you get a vibe for that when we were playing?
I didn't. For me, consuming it was wonderful. I found creating the PowerPoint in our last episode to be like quite laborious, and like remembering to change to the right slide was hard. But then as a player consuming it, it made it really easy for me to keep track of like where I was and what I was doing. And something that we didn't talk about last time that's just now occurring to me, the difficulty in creation versus the ease of consumption. Maybe those economics make more sense when it's one GM and four players.
Yeah, because if you spend a couple hours making a dungeon, you know, your players, just by the nature of having four or five players at the table, there's going to be so much more back and forth about that. I think the time of prep to play is a little bit more in favor of the GM, maybe, for having multiple players as opposed to a one-on-one type game.
But I really enjoyed consuming the adventure as a PowerPoint. It made play like you could go back to the hex map that I had, you know, bought off of a surly dwarf outside the garden. But you could go back to the hex map so I could make my choice about where I wanted to go next. There were two different kind of dungeons that I explored, the hedge maze and then again down a well.
It was a cistern, excuse me.
My bad. The slides just made it really easy for me. I actually really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so before we get too far, maybe just the setup of the adventure, so at least people can kind of follow when we reference it. It takes place in the Duke's Royal Gardens, which is a region that's been sort of walled off. And the sort of hook for the adventure was that sometime in the mid-afternoon, the sun had stopped moving, and it's been mid-afternoon for many days in the garden, and the Duke is looking to solve that problem. People are going mad. Crazy things are happening in the garden, and he's hiring adventurers to resolve it for them. And this was another Bellman adventure where you reprised your role as your rogue Bellman, right?
Absolutely. Bellman, based on Belloc from Raiders of the Lost Ark, who I love playing as, you know, an antiquarian who doesn't necessarily care about people, but has a real soft spot for like creatures.
This ended up kind of being the final Bellman adventure. We'll kind of get to that. But how did you feel about your first hex crawl? This is not the first hex crawl I've run, but it's the first one that me and you have played together, right?
I found it really overwhelming. When you showed the hex map, I mean, there were only 19 hexes. Mm-hmm. But it felt to me like there were so many hexes. And so number one, I felt overwhelmed. Like I've talked about Skyrim, how when I play that, I feel paralyzed by choice. I felt the same way here. Like, oh my God, I can just go to any of these 19 places. Like, where do I even start?
Right.
The first couple hexes that I visited, you told me later it was dumb luck, but they so happened to be hexes that had dungeons inside of them. So my perception was that each of the 19 hexes
had a dungeon,
had a dungeon of like 10 more rooms. So like 190 places to go. It just was like, oh my God, this is not an adventure. It's a campaign is how I felt.
Yeah. And a lot of hex crawls are sort of more campaign focused. This one, you know, like we said, you kind of booked it through this one, all things considered. You hit all the key points of it pretty quick. And we finished this one in just two sessions, really like a session and then another really kind of short wrap up session, if I remember correctly. So, I mean, I think we got through it at record pace, despite, you know, it feeling overwhelming at first. So,
speaking of that, was that a bummer for you? The fact that I was very goal oriented and I had pretty much, again, I hate to use the word beat like a video game, but had beaten the dungeon or was done with the dungeon, with the main issue of the dungeon, in 4 or 5 out of the 19 hexes. Was that a bummer?
It wasn't a bummer. We'll kind of talk about this a little bit later. I wish that you would have come across some other stuff in it, because there is other cooler. So I'm not sad that you beat it fast. I'm a little sad that you didn't see all the other cool stuff that was in the garden. But like you said, you were playing goal oriented, which is what you have to do in a hex crawl, and you went after your goal and you did it. So I can't like blame you for it or anything like that. You know, this adventure was just a little bit, you know, it was a little bit more brief, I think. And we're playing one-on-one too, right? So that's going to make everything go faster. Did you run into any challenges with it being a two-parter for us? It was kind of the first two-parter that we've done, right?
Yes, and it was a couple of weeks between the two sessions.
Yeah.
No, I didn't have any challenges. I was fascinated. Like, we had, so I guess, you know, spoilers ahead. I had been through the hedge maze, where it was this creature made like of all hands that I was fascinated with, and this mysterious light that I interacted with, and I still don't know what's up there. I think probably the most challenging thing for me was knowing that you were running a pre-written dungeon, knowing that I had recently, like just a few months ago, done a bundle of holding that included this dungeon, and like not cracking it open to like see what was going on there. And fun fact, I still haven't read Hideous Daylight. I've read Temple of a Thousand Swords that you ran for me, and certainly I've read Temple of the Moon Priest that you ran for me, but I still haven't read this one. That was probably the hardest part, was not spoiling it for myself. I was very much the kid who, if I knew where the Christmas presents were hidden, I would take a peek. And I didn't do that, and it was rough.
Yeah, sociopath. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, when we were talking about, you're playing goal-oriented, and I think that this is, we both liked the adventure and the setting, but I think if my one biggest critique with it was that you had, so it was a walled garden, right? And there was one way in or out to it, essentially, one official way. And that's the way that you went through. And everything that you needed to do to quote-unquote solve the problem that was going on was in those first 4 or 5 hexes that you had access to. You did not need to cross the garden at any point, right, to get to the dungeon where you found out what was going on, or to solve this problem. And that's what you did. You like you said, maybe dumb luck, or maybe goal oriented, whatever, however you want to phrase it. Like, you just went to the 4 or 5 hexes, and you never had to go to the other hexes, right?
To any GM who told me, I'm going to run Hideous Daylight, here's what I would say. I'd say, okay, look, you enter that dungeon through the southernmost hex. Photoshop that out and have your players enter through the northernmost hex.
Right.
And you will have so much more fun, because neither quote-unquote dungeon is up north. So you could explore each hex as basically a single room conceptually. Mm-hmm. So do that. Like, come in through the north And I don't even know what all's up north. Like, there was a lake in the middle that I never explored. I don't remember any of the features of the north of the Hex Crawl.
Yeah.
But you telling me I had done the only two dungeons and they were both right there by the entrance is like really front loading the complexity.
It's almost like we're designing like a theme park, right? Like, or an exhibit. You kind of want the cool stuff at the back of it. So you got to walk by the gift shop and by the funnel, you know, by the funnel cake stand and all that to get to it.
Yeah. Put the T-Rex last.
Yeah. Yeah. I've run a couple of hex crawls before. So the two main ones, I ran the incredible Dark of Hot Springs Island for my home group, which is just, you know, maybe if we ever want to commit to a long game, I can run that for you because it's just outrageously good. And the goal in that one is to map the hexes. So you kind of want to go to each hex and figure out the one or two things that are there. So there is the expectation and the motive to visit every location. And then I ran another hex crawl for my 5th edition D&D Eberron campaign for my home group. The setup for that was there are three things that you need to find in this region. You have no idea where they are. Go. And so that one, I placed them all kind of far apart from each other in the region so that you were forced to go by the gift shop and by the churro stand and see all the cool stuff that was in the hex and have the decision to, do we press forward? Do we run away? Do we sell all the loot that we have and go to town? Do we, you know, investigate this thing? Is this a time limited type event that's in front of us? And that's all the kind of fun part of the hex crawl. Without that, it kind of just felt like, you know, you were picking a location on the map and choosing to, you know, just investigate there. And it happened to be the four or five locations closest to the front door, right?
Yeah, I wish I'd gotten to experience those hexes. I assumed, like, I think I even made the joke, like, oh, okay, so clearly, you know, the solution is going to be in hex whatever number or whatever number, which were the two hexes, like, furthest away from the entrance hex.
Right.
Like, that was just not the case at all.
and there is maybe something to be said about sort of subverting expectations and not putting it in the furthest away hex, but I don't think you should do that, but I also don't think you should put it in the closest hex too, right? Somewhere between A and B has got to be.
I think subverting expectation is great in carefully controlled scenarios or where there's a lot of familiarity. I think for a D&D adventure, like putting the bad guy in the last room and not the first room is probably what makes the most sense.
Right. Yeah. Maybe it's not really worth mixing that up too much, but yeah, it kind of depends. Or like if there was a magic portal where you started in the middle of the hex crawl, that would have been interesting. Cause then maybe that would have been too overwhelming though. Cause you would have had six directions to go in instead of kind of a vague northerly direction. Right.
True. But basically the entrance point is the main thing that I would change or that I would recommend that GMs change. And that's it.
Yep. There were several unbeatable strange monsters in this, but so it's kind of a different mix-up. Aside from the usual orcs and goblins and giant rats and intelligent crabs that we normally face in our adventures, the sort of setup was that the fact that the sun was hanging in the sky for so long was sort of fraying the edges of reality, and there were creatures or beings from other dimensions coming through, and was that interesting versus the regular orcs and goblins? Were you frustrated by that?
It was frustrating. It was very frustrating. So I think some of the examples, right? And again, spoiler. Some of the examples. There was a rabbit, and I could kill the rabbit.
Yep.
But every time I killed that damn rabbit, it would come back and be like, I think I stabbed it once or I shot it with an arrow or something. I can't remember. But somehow I pierced it. And then when it came back to life, and I tried to kill it again, you were like, hey, you notice that it's tougher to pierce this time.
Yeah.
So like every time I killed it, it became slightly, number one, it came back to life. And number two, it became slightly more immune to however I'd killed it.
Yeah.
So that rabbit was very menacing. And then there was the ball of hands.
Yeah.
That was like super friendly, but also wanted to kill me.
I wanted to examine you and disassemble you, basically. Yeah,
but disassembling, unfortunately, would be fatal for me. And I use the Scarlet Heroes mechanic of defying death to take out that thing.
Yeah.
But my issue, but it was still alive, and like I couldn't damage it enough to kill it. Right. So it just felt like everything I was dealing. It wasn't there like some giant rat that the guards warned me about.
Yep, yeah, there was the wizard's familiar, I think, that kind of got loose and became giant and mutated.
And there were two different rooms, or I think one room, and then they were connected through this mineral where shadows just could infinitely just keep spawning. Like every couple of turns, these like shadow demons kept spawning. So they weren't really necessarily killable. It just felt like in this game where most of the rules are about how to kill monsters, there wasn't a lot of point to killing the monsters. I wouldn't do this every dungeon.
Right.
It made me feel some real tension, and it made me really feel for Bellman's safety in a way that orcs and goblins don't. That's kind of a lot. I threw a lot at you. Like, how do you react to all that? How'd you find running combat?
No, I liked that. Yeah, I can understand how it's a little bit frustrating when you keep encountering things that are tricky, I suppose, and you can't just deplete their HP to zero. Like at a certain point, you kind of want to play the game and hit things and for things to die and you get their treasure. And I think that's like a good, it's not a bad thing to have instincts for in a game, but when everything is subverting your expectations a little bit, you know, and like, yeah, this rabbit keeps coming back to life and these shadow demons keep spawning, I can see how that can get frustrating. I think you're right that maybe not every session should be like this, or even, you know, if you were to populate this hex crawl with three different dungeons, make one of the dungeons like that and make the other two more traditional, I guess. You know, like there has to be a balance between the expected and the befuddling, you know, because if it's all befuddling, then, you know, you're kind of lost, and it can lead to disengagement and frustration, right?
I think to sum this thought process up for me, because I'm maybe expressing it in not great ways, unkillable things and being frustrated by that, we were at the upper bounds of what I would consider okay. Now, we were within those bounds. It wound up being, like, I'm commenting on it because it was different in a fun way, and I really enjoyed it for the experience. But if it was always like this, or if there had been just one more unkillable monster, then I think it would have crossed the threshold into, to your point, disengagement. So be aware of that as a GM. That's a different thing here, and it went great for us. I could also easily see if someone told me, oh, I hate that adventure, I can't kill anything, I could be like, yeah, I see your point.
Yeah, a lesson learned maybe is that unkillable monsters are kind of like a hot sauce, you know, put a little bit on your taco, put a little bit on your Spanish rice or on your eggs or whatever, but, you know, don't add a tablespoon of it to every meal you eat, because you're not going to have a good time.
Perfect.
Can we go back to my, not my checklist, but the checklist that I am obsessed with?
Absolutely.
All right. So let's go through the checklist for this dungeon, and I'm going to read this off and you're going to tell me what you think. So checklist, multiple factions. Did you feel like there were multiple factions in this hex crawl?
No and yes. No, because there were not clear cut factions, but yes, because there was a lot to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
Effectively, in the point of multiple factions, meaning lots of things to interact with and take sides with. Oh, the fire elemental that I took sides with. I would check this, but with the caveat that they weren't technically factions.
Okay. Did you have a good mix of things to talk to and things to fight?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
An excellent mix of that.
Yep, you talk to the wizard at the end and his golem. You talk to, I forget her name, but the adventurer who you encountered, who was trapped in here, and you fought plenty of shadow demons and killer rabbits and hand monsters. So,
in fact, probably my big regret, like, and this occurred to me like days later. You know, it's a great adventure when days later you're like, "Oh, I wish I'd done this." I wish I had made better friends with the fire golem, because he would have been so helpful with the shadow monsters.
He definitely would have. Point number three, were there enough items and traps and puzzles and things to interact with and play with, like things to play with?
Yes. We say items. There was like a pair of boots.
Oh, yeah.
But if I put them on, I would like turn into a plant. So
yeah, they allowed you to photosynthesize, I think, but yeah, like eventually, like you couldn't take them off ever.
Yes.
Or something like that. Yeah.
And I was like, not worth it. So I don't feel like I walked away with any treasure in the adventure, but as far as like puzzles and like figuring things out, there were no like blatant puzzles like Myst where I have to like turn these knobs 8 times or solve this riddle. There's nothing like that. But there was plenty of like, what's going on with this elemental? What's going on with these creatures in this garden? What's going on with these shadows? What's going on with where they're spawning from? What's going on with this mirror? What's going on? Like, there were puzzles in the real world sense of like forensically, what happened here? And then now what do I do? And right. So yes.
And there were choices to do, to like do or not do things with that. Like the, in the hedge maze, when you uncovered the fire elemental, he was wanting to get out, but you could have just chose to be like, nah, and just, you know, left him, but you did release him. And then that led to one thing or another, you know? So I think I agree that it was a success as written with that. And then finally, point four on the checklist, was there something that you should probably run from?
Yes. I really still want to know what was up with those deer with the bloody mouths, because I just kind of walked away. I was like, nope. And I noped out of dealing with them on like the very first hex that I entered. There was an abundance of things that I should probably run from. Yeah. An overabundance, if you will, of things I should probably run from. So yes. Yeah,
we could have toned that one back, like we kind of labored about earlier, a couple notches maybe, but yeah.
Yeah, I think this check, to your point, every box on this checklist is checked.
Yeah, cool. So it must be a good adventure then, right?
And it was.
But finally, maybe the most interesting is that this adventure ended in Bellman's retirement, your character's retirement. Is this the first time you've retired a player character as opposed to them dying ingloriously in battle? I guess, what was your thought process? Did you have any regrets about that?
No, I've retired a couple characters. My favorite character I've ever played was Jean, a kind of underpowered, hapless cleric, and I retired him. So retiring Bellman felt very normal. When you and I started playing together, we talked about like a lot of one-shots and a lot of systems and trying mm-hmm. a lot of different things. So I was expecting it, number one. Number two, even in my media that I consume normally, I love miniseries. So to me, like three adventures with Bellman, was it three? Moon Priests, Thousand Swords, Hideous Daylight, was it just those yep. three? Mm-hmm. Felt perfect. That's a good yeah. Bellman miniseries, and I didn't feel like there was anything else left to say with Bellman.
And where he ended up, spoiler alert, you kind of ended up with a bunch of money from the Duke, and you ended up in a floating wizard home with more books than you could possibly read for the rest of your life, and a servant that was a golem. So, like, we would have really had to do some heavy narrative lifting to swindle you out of that to make you want to go on the next adventure. I feel like Bellman was like, I finally got a hookup and I'm gonna keep it, you know, and it's not like Bellman didn't have enough to do for the rest of his life. But yeah, I think it was the right time to say adieu to Bellman.
How about you? Were you relieved to see Bellman go because he was always so damn goal oriented?
No, I love goal oriented players and player characters. So I wasn't sad to see Bellman go. I mean, I think that he was fun and I liked what we did with him, but yeah, it was the end of his story. And I think after the session, I was like, hey, if Bellman wants to do this, I can run this. And you're like, no, I think he's done. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? You got to respect that. And so if you're satisfied as my player and I'm satisfied as the GM with the story that we told, then I don't think there's any problem with that.
And plus, I get to play a new character who, like playing Bellman, who didn't like people, was fun for a few sessions. But now I'm playing a character who is like really respectful of sapient life.
Yeah, and that's a very, yeah. We'll get to that one once we.
Oh yeah,
in a couple episodes. So, yeah, you got some lessons learned here. So, lesson learned number one: if you're going to have a hex crawl adventure or any other adventure with lots of sites of interest, spread them out. Or be careful where you choose to enter. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, as you will comment upon in our very next episode that we'll probably record, actually, spoiler alert, weeks from now, or behind the scenes alert, weeks from now, I took that lesson to heart when I laid out my first, we'll call it a hex crawl for now until we get to that episode. Really important lesson learned. That was the biggest letdown of this adventure, of this amazing adventure. This felt like a huge oversight.
Yep. And then lesson learned number two, no one to say goodbye. You know, when to retire a player character, say goodbye to Bellman. And, you know, sometimes you got to let things go. That got a little bit deeper at the end than I expected it to. But you know what? Sometimes we uncover life's mysteries on this show.
Absolutely. Amazing adventure. Hideous Daylight. Brad Kerr. Check it out. Move the entrance. Don't change anything else. Absolutely incredible, incredible stuff.
Yeah, highly recommend, and I'm definitely going to be keeping an eye on to see what kind of stuff that he releases next.
People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.